Arts Committee will come to order at 3:22 on April, how do I do that, 29th, 1998. For the record, present are Chairman Rookberg, Vice Chairman Cowdery, Representatives Hudson and Representative Ryan. We have a quorum to conduct business. Today we have a number of bills in our calendar. First we'll take up House Bill 298, then we'll go to 247. Then we'll take up confirmations. There's only six names very quickly. As we're circulating those names for signature, we'll take up 347. Then we'll have the public hearing on 350. After that, we'll take up Senate Bill 254 and House Bill 388, if time permits. For the for everybody's information, it's the chairman's intention to take up House Bill 389 and 300 on Friday. And if we go on the 24-hour clock, we have as many as three Senate bills and other bills that we will be taking up on Friday. As many as possible to complete our calendar as quickly as possible. With that, we have with us Representative Hudgens from Kenai to speak to us briefly on House Bill 298. Representative Hudgens, you're welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. House Bill 298 is an act relating to denial of renewal of a liquor license, providing for an effective date. Because of the time that it's actually sat in committee and the advent of not getting it through the system, I will plan on pulling that after I have a few remarks, if I might. Basically, what I'm doing with this bill is trying to get the ABC board to maybe take a look at some of their regulations, and one of those that I find objectionable is the applicant must operate a liquor license for 30 days a year or shut it in. And I have some real problems with that I've relayed to the ABC board. And I won't belabor the committee here by going through those, but there are some areas of the ABC board that I'd like to look at. Obviously, one that's expressed in this is licenses that come up under bankruptcies. And I do intend to work with them through the interim, and then if there is not sufficient remedies to some of the problems I see, well, then I will put in some legislation for next year. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would ask that House Bill 298 just sit a silent demise until the end of the session. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Hudgens. We will abide by your wishes and recommend that you seek consensus with the ABC board and members of the industry. Thank you very much. Okay. Next, we'll take up House Bill 247. House Bill 247 was introduced by myself.
Mr. Chairman, would you like a motion to adopt the
version K?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'd move the adoption of committee substitute for 247, the version K, and for work before the committee and ask approval.
Any objections? Hearing none, so adopted. Let the record show that Representative Sanders is in attendance at 3:25. Thank you, Barry. Gentlemen, this bill is changed in a very minor way. We had a hearing back in January on it. The title has been tightened in the first page. And if you will go to the second page on line 4, the word, the chapter title, escrow transactions, has been changed from escrow accounts. And throughout the bill where the word escrow account appeared, the word transaction or transactions has been substituted. On the page 2, line 26, the word escrow has been added between depository and accounts, so it reads the monies will be deposited in a depository escrow account. That's the account. On page 3, line 19, the word prohibiting has been added before customers on line 19. And that has to do with the clearance of checks. They're prohibited from drawing until they're cleared. Going through transactions on page 4, line 14, because we made the notation about the depository escrow account, the subsection 2 reads now, depository escrow account means an account that holds escrow money pending completion of an escrow transaction, and that is in a financial institution. Subsection 3 defines the escrow transaction to mean a transaction where, for purposes of effecting closing, sale, purchase, exchange, transfer, encumbrance, leasing, or other disposition of an interest in residential real property, This is one of the major substantive changes to the bill where we are limiting the good funds, this is the good funds bill, remember, to residential and not all properties, just to, this is in the interest of consumer protection. It's the belief of the chair that we can allow commercial transactions to proceed because of the special peculiarities there without the protection of good funding. Lines 30 on 31 on page 4, at the request of the Division of Banking Securities, we've consolidated the definition of a financial institution to an agency of the federal government, which was a testimony at the time. Renumbered on page 5 on lines 12 and 13, added definition of residential real estate, including 1 to 4-plex, and then added the other substantive changes on line 15 of page 5. In terms of the definition of a settlement agent, we've added on the line 15 where it says handle escrow transactions but does not include a financial institution. This was added at the crest of the Alaska Bankers Association to exclude banking financial institutions from the provisions of settlement agent as it relates to their what's traditionally been called their escrow or collection type businesses. This is not intended to mean that. This only has to do with an escrow settlement agent of a residential real estate transaction as defined. So we don't get in cross purposes with that type of business transaction. And we can change the effective date to January 1999. With that, that's the changes. Are there any questions on this? Oh, I also submit to you that we have letters in a package from DJ Webb from the Alaska Title Company of Alaska agreeing to this. And also we received today a letter from John and Ann Ringstead. And I really would like you gentlemen to read this letter. This is the incident that happened in Anchorage where these folks actually closed on their loan. And when and the buyer went to their house, saw a little leaking skylight, called the lender and the state's up, and the guy stopped the funding. Took them, and the, after the if the, the transaction is closed and was recorded, but without funds, it took 4 months for the Ringsteads to get their house back. And they were, and that was by avoiding $30,000 in legal fees and all the rigmarole to do so. That's why this bill is before you. It's called the Good Funds Bill. Refresh your memory. It means that the settlement agent must have the money in hand before he records the deed and conveys the title. The states of Washington, Oregon, and California, among many others, have good funds legislation. Alaska does not. That means that somebody's been playing with the float for too long, and we're going to end it. Is there any objections to moving this bill?
Mr. Chairman, I would move passage, committee substitute for House Bill number 247, the K version, out with the zero fiscal notes attached and ask unanimous consent.
Any objections? Hearing none, so moved. Next, we'll take up the confirmations. Mr. Armstrong, we've put on your table in front of you the list of the conferees, there's some six of them. Yeah, if you would, Ms. Armstrong, thank you. The first is Ms. Karen Maharn. We took this up before. We heard Representative Hodges, let's give her a heads up. This is the woman, we held up the confirmations to confirm that whether or not this was the woman that had took exception with our committee. And, but now we're ready to move forward with this recommendation. Mrs. Armstrong.
I'll for the record, Shirley Armstrong, staff to the Labor and Commerce Committee. Representative Roper is correct. The two on the top of your list there, Karen Maharan was held out of the original batch that we did, and the Martin Kroll. And since we had our meeting, Representative Hudson got with the boards and commissions, and you will find in your behind Mr. Kroll's sheet that there's a copy of a memorandum. And if you look at the third appointment, Kathy Gardner, or below, behind, all the way at the bottom, I guess, is Gary Kanasek. And that was the agreement that someone from the southeast area would be appointed. So with that, the other appointments besides Mr. Kroll and Ms. Maharan have been transmitted to the committee since we last were here.
minutes.
Very good. So we have the Alaska Labor Relations Agency, Karen Maher and Kenai. Any objections to taking that? Hearing none, so moved. Next we'll have Mr. Martin Kroll, let's see, for the Board of Pharmacy, Martin Kroll of Anchorage. Any objections? Hearing none, so moved. Next we'll take up the State Board of Registration for Architects, Engineers, and Land Surveyors, Kathy L. Gardner, P.E. Any objections? Hearing none, so moved.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Ryan.
Have we heard from any of these people?
We have received no correspondence for or against.
And all attached are the various resumes and the personal additional background.
None have testified to the committee on
No. The first two we've had, committee's had communication with those. And, next we'll take up the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers, Inga Boulevard. Any objections? Hearing none. Move that on. Board of Marital and Family Therapy, Wilford M. Miles, Ph.D. Any objections, Dr. Miles? Hearing none.
Give me them.
Oh, sorry.
I'll
pass. Let's take a Board of Dental Examiners, James V. Blasingame. Any objections? Hearing none. So moved. Next, here we are, the Board of Pharmacy, Gary Kanetsi, Ketchikan. This takes care of the judicial district. Thank you, Representative Hudson, for looking into that. Mm-hmm. And with that, we move to that name. That concludes the confirmation hearings on these. I will remind the committee that the signatures of these transmissions do not indicate a vote for or against. We merely have reviewed these people from the appointment by the governor and move their names forward. Next, we'll take up House Bill 347. Representative Cotter.
Yes, we've worked on this bill for some time, both the Department of Labor and the mechanics and the shop owners, and we've come to an agreement, and I would, maybe somebody from Labor or somebody from here would like to speak to an amendment, that the last amendment, and then maybe I'd like to hear from the Mr. Alewine.
This one, do we have a committee substitute, or are we working out the original bill?
He's a committee substitute.
Yeah. Okay, it should be in your packet. And that's version F, is that correct?
It should be version F.
Yeah.
The number again?
Version F, a 347.
Okay.
Act relating to an exemption of overtime wage requirements for certain motor vehicle mechanics. And there is a... Chair, to entertain a motion for adoption of version F.
Mr. Chairman, so move.
Are there objections? Seeing none, so move. Representative Cotter, do you want to speak to the CS we just adopted, and then we'll...
I would just maybe have the representative of the auto. They were the one that worked out the CS. Maybe they'll have them, Mr. Edelwine.
Please, come forward. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and be as brief as possible, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Steve Allwine. I'm the Vice President of the Alaska Auto Dealers Association. I do have, just to perhaps help out a little bit, a statement that I would like, with the committee's indulgence, to read into the record that clarifies what we believe to be everybody's understanding, and I'd like to offer copies of this so that it might help you understand it better.
Gentlemen,
as well.
Why don't you just give us the copies for the record and just briefly describe what this is, as best you can, if you don't mind. And we'll adopt that for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Essentially, we have, through the auspices of this committee and the bill's sponsor, Representative Cowdery, worked with the Department of Labor at your direction. We have reached what we believe to be a reasonable compromise. We, at the outset, did not feel that this was what the automobile dealers or the technicians wanted, but after lengthy discussions and with the help of a number of people, we have reached something that we believe we can support. This bill will remove a restriction that we as employers are faced to place on our employees. It will permit them to work overtime in such a way that's reasonable, and in the same vein, it will give us an opportunity to not be encumbered with an additional liability that currently the Department of Labor is required to work under. That's kind of it in a nutshell. We do support the committee substitute. My understanding is there is a clarification amendment to go with this substitute that clarifies a couple of technical issues. We also support that. We would like to take just a moment and thank the bill sponsor, the chair of this committee, and the individuals at the Department of Labor and the AFL-CIO who have helped us reach this agreement.
Mr. Allen, have you seen the amendment? Could you speak to the amendment? Is this technical in nature?
Yes, sir, it is.
Very, very good. Any questions of Mr. Allen? Mr. Allen, we will make certain that this written testimony is entered in the record, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We appreciate that written testimony. Anybody else? Mr. Perkins or Mr. Flanagan, did you want to testify?
Yeah, Flanagan.
Ed Flanagan, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Labor. Real briefly, Mr. Chairman, you have before you a 2310060D17 that the Department of Labor can live with. And there's been a lot of work by a lot of folks, and we feel that this addresses the need expressed by the industry, but still maintains a floor and still maintains the concept of time and a half after 8 and after 40. And the amendment is really, it may be belt and suspenders kind of protection, but it's to make it clear that the intention, as was discussed all along between the parties, is that it's figured on a weekly basis. Somebody doesn't pick and choose if one day they do better under the flat rate and the next day they do better under the minimum. The minimum owed is figured at the end of the week on a weekly basis against what they earned under the flat rate. And the department appreciates the cooperation of everybody involved, and particularly the chairman and the committee and the sponsor. And we withdraw our objection to the bill as reflected in the CS and the amendment.
So briefly, then you gross it up and then you make sure that they've met the minimums. Is that how the formula works, or is...
That's correct. You figure what they get under the flat rate, sir, and then do this.
They'll
calculation
never,
as a minimum
if
check.
If they put the hours in, they'll not be paid less than the minimum base that you've agreed to under the formulation. Is that correct? Or?
They will not be paid less on a weekly amount figured on the hours worked. Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions? Anyone else to wish to testify on 347? Hearing none, public hearing is closed at 347. What's the will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, do we need to amend?
Oh, yes, we need, excuse me. We need, amendment. Representative Ryan.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move amendment number one as contained in the packet. Is that the one you're interested
right,
in?
Right, on page 2, line 7?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's correct. Is there any objections to amendment number one?
Just a minute. Where is it? Okay, I got it.
Got it. Testimony that the department agrees with the amendment. Any objections? No objections? So moved. What's the will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman. Chairman, I'd move committee substitute House Bill number 347 as amended, F version. Out with individual recommendations and
zero fiscal
notes, and ask unanimous consent. Thank you, Shirley. And ask unanimous consent, sir.
Are there any objections? Hearing none, so moved. Next, we'll take up House Bill 350, insurance coverage for contraceptive. Act relating to the cost of contraceptives and related health care services to be included in health care insurance coverage. And we have the sponsor with us.
What is it?
This is House Bill 350, health insurance contraceptive.
I'll have that one, do it.
You have that file. Let's take a brief at ease, if you don't mind, just to make sure we're all on the same. What's today, Representative Croft, a sponsor of House Bill 350. Representative Croft, welcome to the Labor Commerce Committee once again, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, let me say that was an impressive display there. You moved four bills, got a compromise between labor
don't
and management.
Don't take up our
time. Yeah, you're moving fast.
You need your time.
This is a two-minute testimony committee. HB 350 came out of discussions that I had at the end of last session about what we could do to reduce the number of abortions in this state. Came with a number of Republican representatives, many pro-life. My perspective was what we could do practically, not just getting into into political fights as we did some last time, but is there ways to reduce the numbers, the need for it, if you will? And that led to a couple of chains of events, logic. We first analyzed where do the majority of abortions come from, and they come from unintended pregnancies. That makes sense, I think, to most of us. If you intend to get pregnant, if you're trying to get pregnant, you're very unlikely to then to decide to have an abortion. And that led to where do the unintended pregnancies come from? And almost all the unintended pregnancies are the result of not using or misusing contraceptives. So that led us to this stage. What could we do to allow working families access to contraceptives? Now, a couple of caveats about what we're not talking about. We're not talking about contraceptives for kids. This is an insurance bill. You have to be covered under insurance policy. This is primarily working families who, by working, have access to that insurance policy. It doesn't involve juveniles. To the extent it ever did in a family that had a policy providing it to them, it'd go through the insured, which would be the adult there. So it's not that. It also does not mandate any coverage for abortion. And the bill is very specific in that. We put a very specific letter of intent with it to say what we're talking about is contraceptive services, not abortion services. The fact is, I think to some extent the unfortunate fact, abortion is covered under most insurance policies now. I think that's a rough financial calculus that insurance companies make, knowing that the cost of an abortion is much cheaper than the cost of the full delivery and pregnancy. But for some reason, most insurance companies do not cover contraceptives. We have a number of handouts, and if you pass those out, to show why this, why access to contraceptives saves substantial amounts of healthcare money. It's the classic prevention, an ounce of prevention being worth a pound of cure. When people have access to and use contraceptives, healthcare costs go down dramatically. You have fewer abortions, more importantly, you have it allows families to have children when they want them, to plan them, and there's significant evidence from a number of sources that planned children in a family that is ready and for them, do significantly better. So we save. I think everybody agrees. Society saves money, does better, has when they can have access to these contraceptive services, when they can plan their families. The specific question that the chairman of this committee asked me to address was, does it save individual insurers money? That's harder to find specific results. We could all agree, even in some discussions with the chairman here, we've agreed, yeah, maybe it saves everybody, society as a whole, money. But does it save a specific insurer money to do this? We have the best article is one, The Economic Value of Contraception, from the American Journal of Public Health, and we copied some of the provisions there. They did a statistical analysis. To my knowledge, there's been nobody who's taken, it's hard to get a control group to do this, right? It's hard to do a scientifically valid that deny some people contraceptive and do the others. We do know some things. We know this from that analysis, statistical analysis, and I'd point you to, moreover, businesses and individuals receive an economic benefit if these savings yield lower premiums and increased profits. Who saves? The model suggests the savings generally are realized by third-party payers, the ones who would have to pay for the abortions or the term pregnancies or the cost of these children that are mistimed, if you will. And the chairman also asked me to get specific information, the more specific the better, on how much adding contraceptive coverage costs. There's somewhat of a contradiction there. There is a cost to doing it, any member. The question is, do the decreased health costs that result on down the line end up evening out? The best numbers that we can get, that we have a number of information from Oregon. It's in a handout titled The Oregon Health Plan. They broke it out by, this is the cost to provide family planning services to these different groups, and they broke it out by different. You see it varies from 1 cent a month, this is all per member per month, to a high of $287 per month. The 1% per month is the in their old age assistance categories. You can see why there would be fewer, even very few people having need for family planning services in that area.
No, we're going to ask you how to explain that one set.
Right. That's why. And then we took this information. We got this information.
Until you're 60.
Huh? 60? What do you mean?
I'm not commenting on whether people have sex after 60, but it just doesn't seem to result in family planning services is all.
Clearly there's at least a 1 cent deviation in the study.
I'm offended. It's only 1 cent.
The relevant becomes the total. That is, I asked them, okay, you've got it broken down for a bunch of different groups in a wide variety. What's sort of the average for all the participants in this Oregon health plan? And the statewide average, all groups, is $1.68 per month per payer, about $20 a year. And that conforms pretty closely to what the Health Insurance Association of America has estimated. That we also estimate that the average increase in per employee cost would be $16.20 per annum. Now, we've had some discussions with them. They think that now may be the prescription cost, that is the majority of the cost of providing contraceptive services.
Wait. I'm sorry, I hate to interrupt you on that, but when you're talking about these, how do you reconcile that with the cost of an individual prescription would be $25 a month?
But you're spreading it over, as in any insurance thing, you're spreading it over an entire group.
And then would you tell me what the group is for these figures then?
Well, it's the entire, what the group is for the Oregon?
It has to be connected to a formula, so you need to explain the formula or at least give us a gist of what you're talking about. Mm. It's like these different groups in the Oregon plan, are these
right.
These are different types or levels of care? That's how they analyze that? Or
I
what?
Think it's a state-run plan, and it's primarily a welfare plan, so it's different categories of...
So these would either be under some type of public assistance or Medicaid recipients, you think, then?
Right, and you can see the highest number is the one that focuses most on women of childbearing age. You would expect them to need the most family. So it sort of goes from a low of 1 cent to a high of 287 cents per month. And with the average across the general population being 168, or about $20 a year.
Please continue. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, it's fine, Mr. Chairman. And as I said, that jives pretty well with health insurance estimates of what it costs. We don't know specifically what it saves. We do know it saves substantial amounts. We do know that having contraceptive services available and people using them properly saves healthcare money. So what we can say for sure is it costs individual people $15 to $20 a year, depending on whether which estimate you're talking about, and that there are substantial savings in the system. We can also say, I think, that the more people are allowed to plan their families, the less abortions we can expect. So on a societal level and on a cost level, I think this bill makes good public policy sense. The final handout that we gave you this time with the pie graphs on top, and we just highlighted Russia's experience. For a long time under the Soviet Union, they did not have access to contraceptives. They instead used abortion as a form of birth control. It led to huge rates of abortion in the former Soviet Union. In the early 90s, when contraceptives became available, you saw a corresponding decrease in the abortion rate. When people can have this access, they don't need to use abortion that way. So, for cost reasons, for fairness reasons, because right now women pay much higher health care costs, and the primary reason they do is increased costs relating to family planning services. So there's an equity argument, a cost argument, as well as just a letting working families plan their families.
Does that conclude your testimony?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
I represent Ryan.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I did a little ciphering here. Taking round number of 20,000 state employees be covered by this at $100.68 an employee comes out to cost to the state of $403,200, yet the fiscal note is zero.
Representative Ryan, you'll recall that the state is a self-funded insurance plan will not be covered by an insurance mandate bill, and that's one of the problems. They don't count.
If there are...
Representative Cotter.
If you said earlier, I thought that this would actually save insurance companies money by reducing the number of covered births, but don't you think the insurance companies might be in a better position to determine what, you know, if this was going to be, and if that was the case, would it be reasonable to think they'd already been doing this in their policies?
Excellent question, and Mr. Chairman, Representative Cowdery, I think part of the problem is you fracture up. That comparison that we did before, we can all, I think, agree that it saves overall money. It becomes, I guess, a difficult question of whether it's going to save me individual money as an insurer, when I know my population keeps moving in and out. What we've, you know, so I may be saving the next insurance company down the line money when they move out of my policy. What we've found in looking at the market is that the HMOs do a much better job of providing this coverage because I think they see a much more stable population and they see the savings. We don't have any HMOs really up here, and as I understand it, there's not much of a chance that we will. So we're still left with this sort of fractured market where it's difficult for any individual insurer to see those savings. This, in effect, spreads it all out. You all shall do it. Now I can get the savings from the insurance company up the road from me. So, yeah, I think that they should. They're increasingly seeing it. But it takes a certain stability in your population to do it, and because we don't have the economies of scale for HMOs, I was worried and worried we're not going to see that.
Well, I think probably everyone works towards the objectives that you're trying to do, but they just don't do it at the right time. You know? I mean, that basically. But aren't... how do you envision? You have to get a prescription, or how do you, would you envision this happen? Who would get the prescription? The man, the woman, or
most likely the woman, and be the normal way anyone would get their prescription drugs, since it goes to her. And in almost all cases, you'd go like you're getting any other form of medication. And I'm not dictating the procedures or methods that the insurance companies use, but cover it through your normal procedures.
I suppose we have some insurance people here to testify.
Imagine. No, unfortunately, I don't believe we do. We don't have a teleconference today.
I'm here.
Gordon,
oh, yes. Actually, there is a sign-up sheet if anybody else is not on the sheet, which they aren't, if they could get signed up.
I was upstairs.
No problem. Yeah, if anybody does want to testify on this bill, please give your name to the committee. Where are we? Questions.
Let me ask a question.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, I just want to make sure that I understand. Now, nobody has to have this. This is not something that's imposed on anybody. It's still up to, say, the woman to solicit. And I know it has to be offered, but it doesn't have to be used except at the discretion of the person. So the person has the discretion of use.
Exactly right.
So if it's against your religion or something of this nature there, you just don't use it. Okay, thank you.
Exactly right. And on that point, only in researching, California has considered doing this a couple of times and is close, I think, to doing it now. Governor Wilson vetoed it, but said in his veto message if they fixed one or two things, he'd sign it next time. And the one thing he identified is allowing church-based organizations. Church. Let's take, for example, a church who's getting a health insurance policy for their members may not, for religious reasons, want to have that policy even provided. And I, you know, it hadn't even occurred to me until I read that. But that I'm perfectly willing to do that. So there's two points there. Your point is exactly right. We're forcing no individual to have contraceptive services if they don't want it, only that they have access to it. And secondly, if a group has a religious-based reason for not wanting, if the Catholic Church in Anchorage or anywhere else says we don't want a policy that includes contraceptive services, they don't have to either, and there's an amendment to that effect if you want to.
George Hudson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So then, the exclusion for religious purposes would come in on page 1, line 7, or something thereabouts, as far as the exceptions for. Would that...
Right. Page 1, line 8, I think.
You don't have an amendment. You're just suggesting that you'd be amenable to one if...
We actually had one drawn up, and I'm amenable to it. Just not my committee can't offer it.
What are the questions of the sponsor? I just draw the committee's attention to a letter that was written to Representative Croft from the Attorney General's office dated March 11th. It's in the letter here, which the conclusion thereof is that the state-mandated benefit laws like House Bill 350 may not be applied to self-funded ERISA health benefit plans. You aware of that?
Yeah.
Okay, and you think it's fair to say that the figure of approximately $25 a month for a prescription oral contraceptive is a good figure, more or less?
$300 a year, $25 a month, that's what I understand.
In the range. But this bill does not, what other devices or other contraceptive forms would be covered under this bill?
We didn't limit it by type. We just limited it to not ones that work as early abortions. And the major one that's, there are patches, there are inserts, there are all kinds of different devices that they could, that you can use for contraception. There's some debate, ongoing debate on how an IUD works, and I don't know. We just said in the letter of intent to the extent an IUD is determined to work as an early abortion, it's not covered. If it acts to block the conception, the fertilization of the egg, then it is. We mean to only block those. It's not limited by method, but only those methods that work to prevent the fertilization of the egg, not to take a fertilized egg and do something with it.
I'm passing out the committee right now, Representative Croft, a copy of a press release that came from the Los Angeles Times, March 25th, 1998, which is a story about the California situation. It indicates that there was a contraceptive mandate for insurers was vetoed. And I point out that, let's see, where is it here? Second paragraph said that Wilson said he would sign the bill by Assemblyman Bob Hertzberg, Democrat Sherman Oaks, only if it included a conscience clause allowing employers to opt out of such coverage on moral or religious ground.
Right, and we contacted that office to get, our statutes are a little different, but to get that
My
idea.
My whiz bang staff came up with it.
Pretty good work.
Any other questions?
We should pass this bill to see if our governor will veto it or not, just to compare.
What? Does that mean Pete Wilson and Tony Knowles are going to... No. That's... The chair rules the chair out of order. Representative Kraft. Now, I do apologize for not having a teleconference today. We didn't... Mrs. Armstrong couldn't get the lines in. I know there's a number of people in both the insurance business and other folks that... much in support of this bill, we're not able to testify today. I'll do a wrap-up of certain other things. I just want to put a couple of things on the record there. So with that, we'll go on to further testimony, and hopefully you'll be available. And welcome to join us at the table, sir. Next, we'd like to hear from Dr. Nakamura, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Peter Nakamura, and I'm the Director of the Division of Public Health. I've not had a previous opportunity to testify on this bill, but I have had the opportunity to read some of the testimonies, and I'd like just to make a few brief comments. First off, I'm getting rather tired of getting involved in abortion debates. It's been one series after another for the past 2 years. But there are a couple of commonalities that come out of all of our debates. One is, no one can challenge that these unwanted pregnancies lead to unwanted births that lead to higher instance of child abuse, that leads to higher instance of domestic violence, that leads to more kids who end up in the juvenile justice system at a high cost, all of these at a very high cost to society and to each of us. There's another given that we all seem to agree on. One is that none of us really want to see the continuation of abortions if we can avoid these unwanted pregnancies. And the way they do it is to have contraceptive services to provide these unwanted pregnancies from coming about. And that's what this bill is about. I had an opportunity, as I mentioned, to read some of the comments. And if I just read about two or three or four of them and just briefly tell you what I think of those testimonies that I've heard. One was that the purchase of insurance coverage for conception coverage should be a choice for women. Men and other people have no use for this benefit. Well, first off, there isn't a pregnancy that doesn't involve half a male as a partner. I think they have a role in this pregnancy. Secondly, there isn't a one of us, as I mentioned, that isn't impacted by the negative outcomes of these unwanted births, unwanted pregnancies. So there is a price to all of us. Secondly, contraception is not a healthcare treatment. I read that and I can understand why. A lot of insurance companies see healthcare as clinical medical care. We, and I'm a pediatrician, but I'm also a public health physician, and we see prevention as a healthcare issue. Immunizations, pap smears, mammograms, those are all prevention activities, just like contraception is a preventive health activity. Third issue, everyone should have the choice of the type of insurance coverage they want. That's one of the things that led to healthcare reform, is that the industry was able to target on those who are at the lowest risk, so that young people with no medical illnesses could get health insurance at a very low rate, leaving the more vulnerable, those with higher risk problems, those with more expensive problems, out there by themselves and not able to have the coverage. And that was the value of this overall insurance policy, to spread the risk out among a broader number of people. The fourth thing is contraceptive services are not expensive, so it should not present a barrier to access. That's also been refuted. I read an article just today in the Family Planning Perspectives, and it was a study by the Ellen Guttmeier Institute of 2002 women who were interviewed. And the common response, generally from the women, not just of the poor, but the women in general, is that access to contraceptive services was the biggest reason for unwanted births. Not that they couldn't afford it. Sometimes it was a matter of the issue of understanding the need for it. So contraception goes in two phases. One is making sure that the service is available, and the second is to make sure that they want it. And the last thing I'd comment is one that really floored me, and that was a statement that sex without procreation is a product of the contraceptive mentality. I've got two kids, and I can assure you I've had sex more than twice in my life. So I think that was a very inappropriate and out-of-place statement. And that's all I wish to say, that I'm for this bill, obviously, as a director of health for the state.
Thank you, Dr. Nakamura. The committee certainly appreciates you taking your valuable time to come here and talk about your sex life.
But you know, I said more than twice.
With that, are the questions of the good doctor? Dr. Nakamura.
Sure. Yes.
Do you have any idea how many Alaskans have no insurance in this state or uninsured?
That I would
don't have access
you.
To.
No, I could probably find that, but I don't have that answer, no.
But the figure, excluding the native population, were approximately 70,000 to 80,000 people, about 14% to 15% ring a bell with you?
No, I honestly could not answer that or respond to that. But if you'd like, I'd be happy to find that answer.
Well, this committee's been searching for these answers for literally months and years. We're inching towards the truth. The figure of 33,000 people covered by individual insurance policies ring a bell with you in any way?
See, you're into an area where I can't even begin to answer because I've not looked into this. But like I say, it's an area that I could look into if you so wish.
But doctor, you indicated that you said that everybody should have their own type of health insurance that they have. What did you mean by that?
No, the comment was made that every individual should choose the type of health insurance they have. That was a comment made by an individual who testified earlier on this bill. My comment was that's what's led to the health care, one of the issues that led to the health care reform that we've been experiencing, that those who are young and healthy were able to access health insurance policies at a very low premium, some of these health, these contraceptive services.
But Dr. Nakamura, are you not aware that the most fertile portion of our population, the younger portion, are the ones that usually are more prone to opt out of obtaining health insurance if they have that ability. I mean, that's a known fact. Were you aware of that? They are the most uninsured portion of the population, if they can even, if they had the opportunity of an affordability basis.
And I'm not quite sure what we're relating to, but my impression is that this bill refers to those who are insured.
Yes, but the fact is that the people are more prone that they could be there to help spread the risks, aren't there to help pay for it either. But you're right, they should be, and it's one of the national, you know, I wouldn't say shames or problems that we do have, is those people are don't participate if they have a way to opt out of medical insurance plans. And then they end up relying on the state or charity to be able to take care of them or out of their own pockets if they can afford it.
And my only issue is that if there's anything we can do to bring about a lower number of unwanted births, that's what I'd like to see happen.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I think everybody in this committee agrees with me. Further questions of the doctor? Representative Ryan.
Perhaps I can agree on unwanted births, but a lot of us, if we look back, my mother was 17 years old, married. And she's a Roman Catholic. There's no way in the world she was not going to have a child. It's the name of the game. And I don't think she wanted a child at 17.
Well, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Next, we'd like to hear from Angela Salerno, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Angela Salerno. I represent the National Association of Social Workers. We are very supportive of this bill. We think that this bill is going to have three outcomes. We are going to prevent unwanted pregnancy and abortion. We're going to promote basic, primary, and preventative gynecological health care for women. And we are going to see health care cost savings for the consumer and third-party payers. Now, the debate about abortion has reached a fever pitch in this session. And I look at this bill as kind of the cool heads bill. This is a way for us to reach some common ground and try to stop our skirmishing around abortion. My association is pro-choice. I think you all know that. But we are very tired. We are very weary of skirmishing around this issue because we are not going to agree on it. That's why prevention is the way that we want to go. Intuitively, we know that using contraception is going to create more likelihood of not getting pregnant. But there are also facts that support this. Data from the United States shows us that contraception reduces the probability of having an abortion by 85%. So we know that that is true. We will stop unwanted pregnancy and abortion. Some of the other testimony I've heard on this bill and concerns that some of you might have, some misconceptions about this bill. It's false to think that contraception promotes abortion. We have only to look at other countries such as the Netherlands. The Netherlands has widespread availability of contraception, and they have the lowest abortion rate in the world. Latin American countries, where there are religious proscriptions against abortion, where contraception is not available, some countries such as Peru have twice the abortion rate that we have here in the United States. So again, that's a misconception. Basic primary preventative health care, half the pregnancies in Alaska are unwanted, mistimed, or unplanned. Half the pregnancies. That comes from our own Department of Health research. We've heard about some of the outcomes of unwanted pregnancy. Dr. Nakamura referred to some: low birth weight, birth defects, abused kids. Alaskan women just don't have great options or great access to the most effective forms of birth control. And that would be certainly the birth control pill and other forms of contraception that they can get only from their doctor. 60% of health insurance providers exclude coverage for contraceptive drugs, even though contraceptives are the most widely used drug for women between the ages of 18 and 44. I read a report in the Journal of the American Medical Association that said they reported on an Institute of Medicine report which called contraception largely an unmet need in America. They recommended that a full range of contraceptive products be made available to consumers, and they further urged that third-party payers cover contraceptive services. And what they said was, the costs will reap benefits. Very clearly, they say there will be benefits in overall better health for women and their families, and in the management of overall sexual health. Healthcare cost savings. Representative Croft spoke to this at length. I just want to say, and again, I don't have the data to show this, but prevention is the future of providing healthcare in this country. We see that in the rise of the HMO that has a much better track record at offering preventive services, and in fact, 84% of HMOs around the country now cover oral contraceptives today. Our private fee-for-service providers operate in an almost antiquated medically necessary mode, and I'm sure you'll hear more about that today. What we have is insurance companies, 90% of which cover surgical sterilization, 67% cover abortion, but 50% cover no contraceptive services of any sort. Again, that's in the fee for service, what we're used to, at least here in Alaska. Providing, as HMOs do, contraceptive services has the potential to lower healthcare costs for all. NASW thinks this is good social policy. It's going to prevent unwanted pregnancy and abortion. It's going to promote the overall health of women and their families. And it has the potential to lower healthcare costs to consumers and insurance companies. What we're going to do, and this is working families we're talking about, people who may have to make a decision between seeing the doc, a woman seeing her doctor, getting a full gynecological healthcare exam, and getting birth control, or paying bills. It's just that simple for a lot of working families. So again, we support this bill and be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Salerno.
Ms. Salerno, you deal with many of the people who, quote unquote, have unplanned children. And I know that many of these are unemployed, and I'm wondering how we get to them this prevention, because isn't that really the target group that we need to try to come to?
Through the chair, Representative Hudson, I assume you're referring to folks of very low income.
Yes.
We do have some programs that are helping them today. We have Title 10 funds that come to us from the federal government. I know certainly in the municipality of Anchorage there are some city funds that cover that group. I think the provision of contraceptive care to all segments of society is crucial to the goal of preventing unwanted pregnancies.
So they are covered, you think?
This bill will not help anyone who is not working and
who does not have insurance.
Right. This is actually going to hit a narrower group of folks. Certainly, folks who work and are quite affluent can purchase any kind of contraception they wish or have as large of families as they wish, if that's their choice, and get abortions if that's what they want as well. This bill, I think, is going to affect and help our families kind of on the margin, and especially as more and more folks move from welfare to work, as is our social policy today. I think it behooves us to assist them in any way possible to make sure that they're successful in staying off welfare. I think this will help.
There's a room.
Well, I'm wondering if this bill is trying to more of establish a social policy than to actually benefit a large group, in as much as we've heard the ERISA people aren't covered and for state employees because of what they have. And Representative Hudson was trying to determine the group, and so we don't seem to have a whole lot of people that are going to fall under this.
Mm-hmm.
But by institutionalizing it with the insurance companies, we're trying to establish it as a first step in the door of the social policy. Would that be a good characterization, or am I misconstruing something?
Through the chair, Representative Ryan, if I understand you correctly, are you asking, I'm not sure what you're asking. Yes, it is a change in social and almost economic policy. I mean, we're asking the private industry, we're asking a private industry to jump on board here. And I think it is something different, something that maybe we're not used to doing in a lot of cases, but I think it's a huge industry that has a huge stake in the health and safety of the people that it's covering. I think it's a missing part of a comprehensive system of healthcare for folks. And as you're speaking, I'm thinking maybe I'm narrowing this down too much. We know that, you know, wealth is sort of concentrating more and more into a smaller and smaller group of folks. I think there's quite a few people in Alaska that are going to be helped by this bill. Folks, again, who are living paycheck to paycheck, who may have as large a families as they can handle without, you know, busting the budget. And maybe this, maybe I've gone too far in characterizing this as a narrow group. Maybe it's a quite larger group than we'd expect.
Ms. Salerno, it may have been testimony today, but does the state provide in their Medicaid program contraceptives for?
Yes, the state provides through Medicaid contraceptive services to eligible participants.
Okay. Are there further questions on this one? Oh, Ms. Salerno, I was kind of concerned there about the statements you made. It seems to me that you said that the cost will reap benefits because there is healthcare savings, cost savings, but I'm not sure that this committee or in my research of this topic we've seen any empirical evidence to that. I think we all agree that it makes a lot of logical sense.
Right.
If you can forestall or avoid conception, that it stands to kind of logically follow that there's savings, but there's been a breadth of evidence for that effect.
Mr. Chairman, I was quoting from an Institute of Medicine report, a group coming out of Columbia University, the medical school there, that studied the issue. And I think they're referring more to an even broader issue than just reducing pregnancy. A woman who gets contraceptive care gets a full gynecological exam. Those of us in the room who have had that experience know that you don't get contraceptives unless you get a pelvic exam, a very thorough going over by a physician. So I think what the report was saying, that contraceptive care is a door into overall health, especially sexual health of a woman and her potential family, certainly. A gynecological exam reveals abnormalities and concerns that a family would have about fertility and pregnancy and birth.
Further question. Thank you very much. Next, we'd like to hear from Mr. Gordon Evans, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you all know, my name is Gordon Evans, and I represent the Health Insurance Association of America, which is a national trade association of commercial health insurance companies providing health insurance for approximately 55 million Americans. HIA opposes House Bill 350, and we also oppose the companion bill, Senate Bill 260, for a number of reasons, and not the least of which is that its provisions mandate a specific coverage of something that's really not considered to be basic health care treatment, which is what health insurance policies are supposed to cover. And the consequence of which, in the long run, would be to increase the costs and reduce the efficiencies of managed care. As I've noted on previous occasions, HIA favors the preservation of a system that allows the prospective purchaser of health insurance free choice of which risks he or she wishes to cover from among the various coverages offered by competing insurance carriers. You heard Dr. McNamara object to that. Nakamura, I guess it is. Pardon me. HIA also believes that the choice of how the policyholder spends what funds are available for health care and health insurance, and that we feel they should be free of government decree, and we continue to oppose the proliferation of benefits through government mandate. The proponents of House Bill 350 argue that mandating coverage of contraceptives and related health care services will serve several purposes. First, they say it will increase access to contraception, and we don't doubt that for 1 minute. Secondly, it would reduce barriers to effective family planning. And to be honest with you, I didn't realize family planning was considered to be healthcare treatment. Third, it would help more women prevent unintended pregnancies. And again, that may be true, but again, that's also not really healthcare treatment. And finally, it would reduce demand for abortions. And I assume if you take the previous three purposes that I mentioned, that would be the case. But Mr. Chairman, the services for which this coverage is sought and it would be mandated is actually considered to be elective services. Sterilization in men, anyhow, vasectomies are elective services, certainly not considered to be covered by insurance. Anytime the government requires or mandates certain coverage, that mandate becomes one of the rating factors that insurance companies use in making their underwriting decisions. If the coverage sought by House Bill 350 is mandated, you can be sure that insurance or the premium costs will be increased, even for those people who have no use for it or don't want the coverage. And I think that would touch what Representative Hudson mentioned earlier. And that, I suspect that would be the majority of the insured population. Because, as was mentioned earlier, the younger population unfortunately thinks they are infallible and not and do not get insurance unless they actually have to, or unless they work for the state where it's provided for them, or one of the other companies that provides it. For instance, if this legislation passes and coverage for contraceptive services is mandated, this mandate would apply only really to small employer group policies and certain other group policies, generally those who can least afford the increased premiums. The mandate would not affect Alaska's largest employers, such as the state, although the state generally follows mandates, and that's also an answer, I think, to, I think Representative Hudson made a comment on that earlier. It wouldn't apply to cars. It wouldn't apply to BP, ARCO, Exxon. They have a partial application to the municipality of Anchorage because they are partially insured but partially self-insured. It wouldn't really apply, I understand, to individual policies because those are separately rated if people desire that coverage. And so these large employers are mostly self-insured and subject to federal ERISA law, which preempts state law. And it also wouldn't affect those with federal insurance coverage, such as Indian Health Service or Champas. And as I noted, Mr. Chairman, mandated benefits are costly, and those costs will be passed along to policyholders. HIA would not be opposed, I should say, to a mandate to offer coverage for contraceptives and related health care services. As a result of a mandated offering, individual policyholders, as well as employers and their employees in the affected group policies, would be able to choose whether they want to spend additional funds on this particular coverage. In other words, Mr. Chairman, those who want to avoid unwanted pregnancies by the use of contraceptive devices may do so, but they, and not the insured population in general, will pay the cost of the insurance coverage. Simply substituting the word offer for the word provide on line 9 of page 1 would make this coverage sought a mandated offering, and I believe it would accomplish at least part of the purpose of the bill's proponents. I'm sorry I didn't hear Representative Croft's testimony, because I was up in HES committee on another bill, but I know that the opponents in the other body have used, the proponents of this bill, have used a memorandum that was put out by a California lobbyist representing my group as a in a 1996 bill, which required health insurers to provide coverage for contraceptives if they include prescription drug benefits in their plan. It sounds something like what the bill that Governor Wilson vetoed down there.
They haven't seen it, though, so you have to argue against it.
Well, I just want to point out, though, that when I came in, Representative Croft was talking about costs, the cost that would be involved, so that's what I want to point out. Because the use or the comment was made that the cost would really be only about $1.35 per month per employee to for contraceptive services. But that's misleading, because the California bill that this was aimed at, and the newest one, covered only the cost of contraceptive drugs, such as birth control pills. It did not include costs of contraceptive devices or appliances or the cost of the related health care services. So those are not included in this in the price that's been used by the proponents in the other body, anyhow, to say that the cost would only be $1.35 per month per employee. That's the end of my testimony.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Evans, the related health care services, are we talking about the, does that include a gynecological examination?
Yes, you pay the doctor's bill when you go see the doctor, and any services that the doctor does besides prescribing
isn't services. Isn't a service like that under a normal policy allowed for a woman, pap smears,
pap smears are, and I assume certain other services are, but you know, there could, and I don't know what exactly what all related health care services would be, but
I'm just trying to sort that out, because it seems that since that is something that's already included in the policy, and if they birth control, it would be incidental to a normal examination. At least I would think it would be. I just want to clarify that. Thank you.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gordon, do the companies you represent now routinely offer contraceptive services and things of this nature?
In individual policies, if the individual asks for it, it's, you know, it's considered in the what the amount of the premium is going to be. It's not generally offered by most of my clients, or most of the companies that I represent. It's not generally offered by them.
Is it offered by the state, or is it provided by the state in its self-insured package, to your knowledge?
No. It is not to my knowledge at this point.
Yeah.
I'm a little bit too old to at this point to be worried about, so I have to admit some that I'm not sure of that. Maybe some of the younger people could tell us, but
anybody knows, I'd like to have it put on the record somewhere.
We'll maybe.
Yeah, don't ask. Now let me vote and go back to my
business.
The
record show that Representative Bryce is back.
Back. Sorry, Mr. Chair. Tried to help John.
Further questions, Representative Cotter, please.
Yeah, if this becomes a mandate that you do this, what's to stop requiring, or stop us from requiring plastic surgery, facelifts, or other things like that, or nose jobs, or whatever?
Through the chair, Representative Cowdery, well, that's exactly why we are opposed to mandating benefits. As I said, we don't oppose mandating offerings of benefits, but because that means we have to offer it. And if they want it, then they can pay us for it. But when you put in mandating benefits, pretty soon, it's happening already. There's mandated coverage. And we did not oppose the pap smear and PSA tests as such. We didn't mandate the 48-hour stay, oppose the 48-hour stay mandate. We opposed the mandating of them, but we didn't oppose the actual services. I mean, those are common. There was no evidence in Alaska, for instance, that 48-hour birth stay had been required, and people were being kicked out of the hospital. But it was something happened in South 48 apparently a lot, and so it was why it was put in. But
right now, and talking of what you're talking about, we can, if you want dental, you pay for it, right? If you want hearing in a policy, you have an option to take that, and you pay money, or for eyeglasses or things like that. So that option could be available the same, you're saying, if the contraceptive.
If it's made an offering, mandated offering, it would be available just like the others are.
But this, vision, so. Yeah. If this passes, would you assume there'd be an increased cost of premiums?
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Ryan.
As a mandate, there would be an increase, but if there was an increased offer.
As an offer, it wouldn't be increased unless it wouldn't be an increase to the general insured population, only those who chose to take it.
Yeah. Oh, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, one of the parts of the testimony was that we're looking to try to reduce or eliminate the unwanted children or pregnancy leading to children and the abortion and things of this nature. Wouldn't you see, or wouldn't your company see some offsetting reductions in costs that have been testified that result from, say, the cost of abortions or the additional insurance cost for maybe unwanted children or maybe children with fetal alcohol syndrome or something of that nature? Gordon, I'm trying to look for the balance point in this whole situation.
Through the chair, Representative Hudson, that's kind of a difficult question to answer because obviously the insurance industry has not taken that view, and that's not to say that I, as a personal view, and I think I mentioned this to Representative Ryan, sometimes I wonder why the insurance industry doesn't work more toward preventive maintenance than just after maintenance. But that's a personal view, and I just can't answer your question why the industry itself hasn't done so.
Thank you.
Take a brief at ease. You're not done yet, Greg.
Yes, sir.